Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the History of Scotland podcast. My name is Fraser, and as always, I'm thrilled to have you join us as we continue our journey through Scotland's rich history. If you're a first-time listener, welcome to the community. If you're a returning listener, thank you for your ongoing support. It really keeps the wheels turning here. Last time, we delved deep into the fascinating early life of David I. We explored his formative years in the English court, an experience that heavily influenced his ideas and governance style. We followed his life as a Prince of the Cumbrians, a role that would serve as his political training ground for his future kingship. Now, in today's episode, it's going to be a big one, so strap in. We're going to cover a significant swathe of David I's reign, from the moment he became King of Scotland to the later years of his life. It's all filled with battles, political manoeuvrings, and social changes that would lay the foundation for modern Scotland. It's a story packed with characters who are at once bigger than life and entirely human, facing challenges that have echoed across the centuries. So, you can see we have a lot on our plate, and rightly so. So this episode may be a bit long. I don't really want to split this episode up more, so enjoy around 30 plus minutes of content here. The next episode we'll try and aim for a small time frame, but then again, it's the Davidonian Revolution, so who knows. Anyway, get ready, sit back, grab a cup of coffee or tea, and let's dive right in. Let us begin back where we left David as he heard the news of his brother's death. Ascending to the throne of Scotland was far from a straightforward affair for David. His path to kingship was forged through a blend of circumstance, political manoeuvring, and a dash of providence. Let's dig into the details to understand how David I became king and what exactly this process entailed. The throne, as we know, was occupied by his brother Alexander I before David. Alexander, being the older brother, had ruled Scotland from 1107 until his death in 1124 AD. However, Alexander's reign was fraught with his challenges. While he was a capable ruler, he lacked one crucial element that would ensure the continuation of his line, something that all medieval rulers made sure to try and have: an heir. Though married, Alexander did not have any illegitimate children to succeed him. This vacuum of power opened up an arena of speculation and anticipation. David was well positioned, not just by blood, but also by political savvy and support, particularly from the English court, where he had spent much of his life. When Alexander passed away, the decision to crown David as the king was significantly influenced by David's own political alliances and standings. His marriage to Maud, 2nd Countess of Huntingdon, had fortified his connections in the English court. Additionally, his relationship with Henry I of England, as we know from last episode, gave him a formidable backing. David had always been a favourite of Henry's, particularly because of the influence of David's sister, Matilda, who was also known as Edith, who also was Henry's queen. Now, just take one second to imagine David. He hears the news of his brother's passing and he makes his way to Scone. David was crowned at Scone in either April or May of 1124 AD, an ancient Pictish capital all the way back from our earlier episodes, and it was the traditional crowning place of the Scottish kings of this generation. Scone was more than just a geographical location. It was a symbol of Scottish sovereignty. The Stone of Destiny, also known as the Stone of Scone, played a critical role in this ceremony. The crowning ceremony was a deeply religious and also highly political affair. Let's walk through what such a ceremony would have looked like. First, David would have been anointed with the holy oil, a practice borrowed from the Old Testament, and one that signified the king's sacral status. The archbishop, likely surrounded by other clergymen, would have been the one to perform this ritual. Following the anointing, David would swear an oath to uphold the laws and defend the church. The coronation would also involve a public display of the royal regalia, scepter, orb, and crown, which have been handed down to David one by one, each with its own symbolism and significance. Then the archbishop would place the crown upon David's head, signifying his acceptance by both the church and the realm. After the coronation, a grand feast would usually follow, serving as both a celebration and an immediate opportunity for the new king to assert his authority and discuss matters with his nobles. However, David's ascension was not met with unanimous support. As we know from last episode, William FitzDuncan, the son of King Duncan II, and Malcolm, son of Alexander I, were natural competitors to the throne. While they didn't have any political machinery that David had, they had their own set of supporters, mostly among the local nobility. Their claims were less about their capability to rule and more about an old tradition of succession that did not always pass directly from father to eldest surviving son. And some of our long-time listeners will know this is how the place used to be ruled. This is how the Kingdom of Alba and the Kingdom of Picts used to be ruled. You could have an uncle, a nephew, anyone take the throne. Whereas, obviously, we're now going for a bit more of a primogeniture approach. Either way, among those who supported David were his immediate family and allies in the English court. Furthermore, many Scottish nobles who had lands in England had reason to support David's claim, as they expected his reign would be beneficial for them. David's affable personality and his years as Prince of Cumbrians had also won him a good number of supporters within Scotland. It's important to note that David I enjoyed support from a wide range of nobles and families, both Scottish and Anglo-Norman, which helped pave his way to the throne and stabilise his reign. Some of the noble Scottish families who supported David I were the Bruces, the Stuarts, and the Macduff clan. Their support was instrumental in reinforcing David's authority, especially in the early years of his reign when establishing control was crucial. On the Anglo-Norman side, the De Bruce family, which originally hailed from Normandy, were among his staunch supporters. As we heard last time, Robert De Bruce was a close advisor to David and played a significant role in David's efforts to introduce Norman law and customs into Scotland. The Balliols were also another Anglo-Norman family that aligned closely with David, further cementing his influence and reach. Moreover, David's connections with the English royal family offered a level of stability and credibility to his rule. His sister Edith's marriage to Henry I of England played a significant role in this alliance. Henry I's influence also attracted other English nobles to David's cause. We should also not forget his ties to the church, which were also a form of support. Bishops and abbots, such as those from St Andrews and Dunfermline, where he grew up, were among his backers and played a role in his administrative reforms. However, it's worth noting that we'll delve deeper into these relationships, particularly how these noble families rose to prominence and became major landholders under David I in a future episode. The intertwining loyalties and the lands these families would acquire during David's reign are a fascinating subject on their own, deserving a bit more of a detailed explanation, so stay tuned for that. Outside of his Cumbrian principality and the southern fringe of Scotland proper, David exercised little power in the 1120s, and in the words of Richard Oram, was the King of Scots in little more than name. He was probably in that part of Scotland he did rule for most of the time between late 1127 AD and 1130 AD. However, he was at the court of Henry in 1126 and in early 27, and returned to Henry's court in 1130, serving as a judge at Woodstock for the treason trial of Geoffrey de Clinton. Malcolm Mac Alexander was an illegitimate son of Alexander I of Scotland, and thus had the claim to the Scottish throne. In his eyes and those of his supporters, his bloodline granted him a valid stake in the kingdom's leadership, setting the stage for a bitter struggle against David I. Malcolm's justification for his claim to the throne was rooted in the tradition that supported the rights of illegitimate offspring, especially when their fathers had been kings. Although David I was clearly the legitimate heir, being the youngest son of Malcolm III and Queen Margaret, Malcolm and his faction believed his lineage should not be disregarded, particularly as it pretended to the older Gaelic traditions of Scotland. The first war between David I and Malcolm erupted not long before David's coronation. David had already solidified alliances both in Scotland and in England. On the other hand, Malcolm relied more on the support of local chieftains and lords who were still attached to the old ways and saw David's Norman influence as a threat to their customs and power. The struggle was not just for the crown but also represented a deeper cultural and social divide. The war was a collection of skirmishes, sieges, and tactical manoeuvres rather than a single defining battle. David, having been exposed to Norman military tactics in his youth, had a well-organised force that utilised archers, and cavalry efficiently. Malcolm, on the other hand, relied on the more traditional Scottish infantry tactics that we've gone over, utilising the rough terrain of Scotland to his advantage where he could. Ultimately, the First War was resolved in David's favour. The details are not entirely clear from what I've tried to look at, but the records and chronicles suggest that David's forces managed to corner Malcolm and his followers, forcing them to surrender. Some say Malcolm was captured and imprisoned for a while, but was later released when he renounced his claim to the throne. What is clear is that after the conflict, David's reign was relatively more secure, and Malcolm was politically neutered, at least for the time being. Following his defeat, Malcolm went into exile, his eyes still set on the throne. Ireland became his place of refuge, where he sought to make new alliances to bolster his future attempts at reclaiming the throne. Ireland was a strategic choice as it was outside David's immediate sphere of influence, and it was home to various groups who were wary of the expanding Anglo-Norman influence in the British Isles. His allies in exile included disaffected nobles from Scotland and local Irish chieftains who shared a common enemy in the Normans. Thus, Malcolm's exile was not a retreat but a strategic withdrawal, a period of regrouping that would set the stage for future conflicts. However, the First War had established David not just as King of Scotland, but as a monarch willing to adapt and utilise diverse resources and tactics to secure his realm. This was but the first chapter in their long and complex relationship. The Second War against Malcolm kicked off in 1134 AD, less than 2 years after the resolution of the first conflict. Malcolm had been in exile in Ireland, where he had allied himself with some of the local chiefs, as we know. When he returned, he found a willing ally in the ruler of the northern province of Moray. This person was Ongus. He had his own axe to grind with David I. Ongus was the Mormer of Moray. But why did he throw in his lot with Malcolm in the first place? Well, it's worth noting that Angus had his grievances with David, as I said, stemming from David's attempts to exert control over the northern territories, which included Moray. The consolidation of royal authority didn't sit well with the fiercely independent spirit of the region, and Angus saw an opportunity to push back. Malcolm and Angus joined forces in what can only be described as an opportunistic alliance to challenge David I. Now, with the alliances secured, Malcolm and Ongus ignited the second war against David. The decisive confrontation occurred at the Battle of Strathcrow in late 1135. This wasn't just a clash of arms, it was a clash of military philosophies. David I employed tactics he had learned from his time in England and during his tenure as the Prince of the Cumbrians, which included a more organised structure of command and a more effective use of cavalry, not to mention the siege engines like trebuchets. On the day of the battle, David employed a tactic known as the feigned retreat. He initially pushed back his forces, tempting Malcolm and Angus to break their formation and charge ahead. When they did, David ordered his hidden archers to release volleys, creating chaos in the charging ranks. At this point, his cavalry swung around the flanks, enveloping Malcolm and Angus's men. The strategy worked flawlessly, and David's forces crushed the opposition. Angus was killed on the battlefield, and Malcolm was captured, and he was to spend the rest of his life in captivity. Following the battle, David's rule was more secure than ever. David I had won, but not without cost. Yet the repercussions of this victory were momentous. Malcolm was captured and would spend the rest of his life as a prisoner, a shadow of the contender he once was. Angus, as we said, died on the battlefield, apparently bravely, but still nullifying the immediate threat from the north, from Moray, where Macbeth used to hold his land. David I's triumph served multiple purposes. It not only solidified his claim to the throne, but also sent a stark message to anyone who would contend against his throne. With Malcolm imprisoned and Angus dead, the most significant threats to his reign were effectively neutralised. But David didn't stop at military victory. He used his success to further entrench his authority and pave way for the administrative and legal reforms, setting stage for the period we now call the Davidonian Revolution, which we'll explore in the next episode. Following the second war against Malcolm and the demise of Angus of Moray in 1135, David I turned his eyes northward. The north, especially regions like Moray and Ross, had been traditionally autonomous, often serving as strongholds of resistance against centralised rule. David knew that leaving these areas unchecked would pose a constant threat to his authority. The first step in his northern campaign was to formally annex Moray, which had been the power base of Angus. David couldn't afford to let it remain a hotbed of insurrection. He replaced the native leaders with loyalists and subdivided the area into smaller chiefdoms, directly controlled by the crown. This helped dilute the power of local magnates and ensured that the king's rule ran supreme, even in the farthest corners of the kingdom. The Mormondom of Ross was another strategic priority. The region had played a crucial role in supporting Angus and Malcolm during the Second War, and David certainly couldn't let that happen again and allow it to also remain as a hotbed of insurrection. Through a series of deft political manoeuvrings, including strategic marriages and the bestowing of lands and titles to loyal supporters, David succeeded in integrating Ross more closely into his kingdom. Another political action was the establishment of fortified strongholds and castles throughout the north. David understood the military value of a well-placed castle both as a detriment and a base for launching expeditions. The castles, often managed by English or Norman nobles loyal to David, also acted as centres of royal power and administration. This too was a lesson David had learned from his time in England. But David's rule was not only about military and political control. He also attempted to culturally assimilate the entire region. Taking a page from his experiences in England and the south of Scotland, David introduced normal feudal culture into the north. He invited Norman and English clergy to establish churches and monasteries, hoping that these institutions would serve as a cultural centre that paginated the feudal norms and the Christian piety he sought to instil in his subjects. In essence, David's approach to dominating the north was multifaceted. He employed military power, but he also used administrative reforms, political machineries, and cultural shifts to make his rule more palatable and his acceptance more widespread. By the late 1130s and early 1140s, David I had effectively subdued the north, turning it from a place where constant threats came from to an integral part of the increasingly centralised kingdom of Scotland. David I faced other immediate challenges in the western territories of Galloway, which were notorious for their independence and often resisted centralised control. Around 1138, David I initiated a series of campaigns and diplomatic moves to bring the western lands under his authority. He extended a hand to Fergus of Galloway, the dominant lord of the region, offering recognition and possibly even some level of autonomy in return for his fealty. By 1140 AD, Fergus had become a staunch ally, providing troops for David's various campaigns. Despite the diplomatic inroads, David I didn't entirely trust the nature of the Western lords, who were very volatile in nature. To ensure compliance, he began the construction of, you guessed it, several more fortifications by 1142, most notably Treve Castle, to act as both a deterrent and a base for royal power. The regions of Caithness and Sutherland posed a unique set of challenges as well. These territories had substantial Norse presence and had various points been under influence of the Kingdom of Norway. Around 1141 AD, David initiated a dialogue with the then King Harald Gyle, leading to a series of agreements that clarified the spheres of influence in these territories. The diplomatic manoeuvring culminated in a formal agreement by 1150, where the boundary stones were set to delineate Norse and Scottish territories. David I permitted Norse law to continue in local matters, but Scottish law was made supreme for issues concerning the broader kingdom. The Highlands were an amalgamation of tribes and clans, each with their own alliances and rivalries. Beginning in 1151 AD, David I initiated a divide and rule strategy. He strategically bestowed lands and titles on friendly clans, like the Mackays and the Munros, making them dependent on the crown. In doing so, he pitted them against the more resistant tribes, undermining any unified opposition against his rule. The cornerstone of his Highland policy was the construction of castles and forts, like the castle on Loch Ness, established around 1153 AD. These not only acted as military bases, but also as administrative centres that enforced the king's law throughout the Highlands. By 1156 AD, David I had effectively secured his rule over these regions, not just through military might, but also through skillful diplomacy and the establishment of strategic alliances. This mix of soft and hard power had a lasting impact on the governance of Scotland, bringing a considerable part of its territory under more centralised control than ever before. If we turn our attention south, Scotland and England's relationship was deeply entangled, woven with complex threads of family, feudal ties and political manoeuvrings as we know. David I himself was a symbol of this intricate relationship. Brought up in the English court, he was a Normanised prince, whose sister Edith was married to the king. Therefore, with such familial and political alliances, the two kingdoms were never far from diplomatic negotiations, or, if those failed, open hostilities. David I took a nuanced approach towards England through his reign. Initially, he maintained a strong alliance with the English throne, owing to his familial connections with his sister, who was the Queen Consort, and her daughter, Empress Matilda, who was a critical figure in English politics. David's early years saw him supporting Henry I in England, and later his stance changed in a bid to leverage English disarray for Scotland's territorial gains. Queen Matilda, formerly known as Edith, passed away in 1118 AD, which was a significant turning point for David. She had played a vital role as a mediator between her husband Henry I and her brother David, and her death weakened this diplomatic bridge. It also removed a strong female voice from the courts of both kingdoms, creating a vacuum that influenced David's changing views towards England's and Henry's towards Scotland. After the death of Henry I in 1135 AD, England was thrown into a succession crisis known as the Anarchy. Any history of England fan will know this period very well, so I'll not retread the same ground of many past podcasters, but in short, Stephen of Blois, Henry's nephew, seized the throne, bypassing Henry's daughter and David's niece, Empress Matilda. In retaliation, David led a military invasion into northern England. Stephen had to submit to David's invasion. He didn't have the support to fight on two fronts, that being Scotland and France, so he signed the First Treaty of Durham. It concluded in April 1136 AD, and it was a triumph for David. It allowed his son, Henry, to hold lands in Northumberland, Cumberland and Westmoreland. Peace was secure for Stephen between him and David. However, it did not settle the succession issue, setting the stage for further conflict. In March 1137 AD, King David, ready and eager to fight for his niece again, invaded the north of England with a Scottish army. After crossing the border, King David dispatched his nephew William, a force of Galloway men, to the west of England, while King David, with the greater part of his army, laid siege to the castle of Northam on the River Tweed. King David marched further south through Northumberland and Durham into Yorkshire. In the north of the country, he then found himself at the land of Northallerton. King Stephen was hard-pressed in the south of England, resisting the revolt of many of the barons, and left the defence of the north to the local leaders. The Scots committed extensive atrocities on the English civil population as they advanced, leading the English to look on their resistance as a form of religious crusade. Their defence against the invading Scots was galvanised by the aged Thurston, Archbishop of York. Thurston ordered the clerics of Yorkshire to process with their crosses, banners and relics, and to assemble all men capable of bearing arms at Thirsk under the northern English barons. The Archbishop Thurston presented his banner to the senior barons gathering to lead the army, in particular William, Earl of Albany and Walter Lesbeck. The English army took up the position on the Culverton Moor to the north of Alverton, later known as Northallerton. On the moor, the English soldiers erected a standard, comprising a ship's mast lashed to a four-wheeled cart, a crucifix at its head, and the banners of the three patron saints of Yorkshire, Peter of York, Wilfred of Ripon, and John Beverley. This device gave the battle its name, the Battle of the Standard. Walter Lesbeck arranged the English troops from the cart and gave his hand to William, Earl of Albany, exclaiming, "I pledge thee my troth to conquer or to die." The representative of the Archbishop gave an address to the assembled knights at the end, which the lines of the advancing Scots army came into sight. The English knights dismounted and sent their horses to the rear, forming a long line with the infantrymen facing the advancing Scots, the chariot containing the standard in the rear. Archers from Yorkshire mingled with the other soldiers, rather than forming a distinct block. A group of senior knights formed a sacred band around the standard. The advancing Scots army was larger than the English force, although substantially weaker in number of knights and archers, the majority being Highlanders and Picts of Galloway, armed with target shields and broadswords. The Scottish King David ordered his knights to take the head of the Scots column with the archers and to spearhead the attack. At this order, a furious row broke out in the Scottish ranks. The Highlanders and the men of Galloway were not prepared to permit the lowland knights and archers to strike the first blow. When King David persisted in maintaining this formation, the Earl of Strathearn denounced his reliance on Frenchmen and insisted that without armour he would force his way into the English ranks. King David was forced to abandon his plan of attack and permit the Galloway men to lead the assault. The reinforced army advanced in several lines. The Galloway men led the centre of the first line. The right wing of its first line was commanded by Prince Henry, the king's son, leading the lowland knights with a bodyguard of men-at-arms under Eustace of Fitzjohn, a Norman baron of Northumberland who had turned against King Stephen after the forfeiting of the castle of Bamborough and the levies of Strathclyde and Tervedale. On the left wing of the first Scottish line were the English speakers of Lothian and the Highland clans of Lorne, Argyle and the Hebrides. The second line of the Scottish army comprised the Highland and the Island clans, armed with target shields and two-handed claymores and pole axes. King David led the reserve of a body of Saxon and Norman knights and men-at-arms with the men from Array in the rear. As the Scottish army advanced against the English, Bruce and Bernard de Baliol rode up to King David and attempted to persuade him to enter into a truce with the English king, offering to obtain from King Stephen a grant of the earldom of Northumberland for King David's son Prince Henry. Bruce was driven away by the Scottish knights, who called him a traitor. The men of Galloway reached the English first and attacked the centre of the English line, shouting their war cry, "Albanac! Albanac!" The English common soldiers in the first line were severely shaken by the savage attack of the men of Galloway and began to fall back, but the suffering stiffness of the knights was sufficient to hold the attack back and restore the English line, driving back the men of Galloway. The men of Galloway renewed their assault, but were unable to break into the English line like they had done. The men of Galloway delved deeper and deeper, but still couldn't break through. A number of further assaults were diminishing, and the ferocity was going down. The English then surrounded them and began to fire arrows into the ranks. Some of the Scots are said to have looked like pincushions from the number of arrows stuck in their bodies. On the Scots' right wing, Prince Henry came up with his knights and the men from Strathclyde and Tavoot, the knights leading the charge on horseback. Prince Henry and his men hacked his way through the Yorkshire levies, the survivors emerging on the far side of the English line. Henry's men saw the English horses held riderless some distance behind the English line and made for them, in the expectation that the rest of the Scottish first line would follow them through the gap in the English army. In fact, the English troops closed up behind the Scottish knights and drove back the men of Strathclyde. In the centre, the impetus of the Scottish attack had been lost, and the men of Galloway dispersed and left the battlefield, leaving the bodies of their chiefs, Donald and Ulleck, on the battlefield. On the left wing, the men of Lothian and Lorne made one feeble attack and then forced their way and turned away from the battlefield and left. King David attempted to lead the Highlanders of reserves into an attack to support his son and centre right of the first line, but the Highlanders, seeing the battle going badly for the Scots, melted away, leaving King David with his bodyguard and knights. King David withdrew to a hill where he assembled the remains of his army that had not fled the field. Prince Henry, finding himself isolated behind the English line with the few survivors of his body of Scottish knights, joined the advance of the English army, unnoticed until he was able to slip away and join his father's retreating troops as he withdrew into Scotland. Putting a number on the casualties is as difficult as assessing the numbers in each army before the battle. Of the 200 knights Prince Henry led into the attack, only 19 returned, the rest being casualties or prisoners of the English. Heavy casualties were suffered by the men of Galloway and many of the chiefs in the centre and the right of the Scots' first line that fell in the battle. Few of the English knights were killed or wounded, but the casualties among the ordinary members of the English third were heavy, although unrecorded. Following the Battle of the Standard, King David marched to Carlisle, where he awaited his son Prince Henry. By the way, I know I've just been mentioning Prince Henry, like you should know, oh, he has a son called Prince Henry. Don't worry. I'm going to, in the next episode, because we can't fit it in this episode, in the next episode, before we go through the Davidonian Revolution, we'll do a quick 10-minute catch-up on his family. We'll discuss his wife a bit more in detail, and then his kids, and then we'll discuss his culture reforms and the Davidonian Revolution as a whole. Sound good? But just know for now, he has a son called Prince Henry. The Scots then attack and took the castle of Wark, before withdrawing, finally, back to Scotland. Anyway, hope we enjoyed that battle and campaign walkthrough. I don't normally do them, but with sources becoming more rich, I'm going to delve a lot more into detail on the battles and campaigns like this in the future, if obviously the sources permit. Anyway, the Second Treaty of Durham was signed in 1139 AD, about a year after the Battle of the Standard. The treaty came as a resolution to hostilities between Scotland and England that had been sparked by the English succession crisis in the first place. While the Battle of the Standard had been a military setback for David, it didn't end his influence in Northern England. Politically, both sides found themselves in a position where a peace agreement was beneficial. The negotiations were likely complex, involving various nobles and churchmen from both sides. Eventually, though, an agreement was reached that was favourable for both parties. The treaty allowed David's son Henry to keep his earldom of Northumberland, and in some accounts, additional territories like Carlisle and Doncaster. However, these territories were held under the seigneury of the English king, so as a fief, essentially making Henry a vassal to Stephen. The Second Treaty of Durham can be seen as a diplomatic victory for David, despite losing the Battle of the Standard. So you might think that's now the end of David's invasions of England. But it is not. Empress Matilda, David's niece, landed in England in 1139 AD, breathing new life into the civil war against Stephen. David, allying with his niece Matilda, launched a series of invasions into Northern England again. From 1138 to 1141 AD, David managed to capture key strongholds like Wark, Alnwick and Newcastle. However, these gains failed to decisively tip the scales in Matilda's favour. Stephen remained a formidable opponent, and the English throne stayed out of reach for David's family. He left back to Scotland again to reap the rewards of his invasions, but still ponder the question of his legacy. Well, folks, we've reached the end of another enriching episode, driving into the life and reign of David I of Scotland. We've covered a lot of ground today, from David's ascent to the throne, to his dealings in England, to his territorial conquests and consolidation of power within Scotland. Next week, we're going to dive into another significant aspect of his reign, the Davidonian Revolution, which transformed the social, economic and religious landscapes of Scotland. Trust me, you won't want to miss that one. And as I said, we'll touch upon his family and we'll go through his kids, his children and his wife in a bit more detail since we couldn't fit it in here. Anyway, as always, our podcasts are out weekly and we've got two more episodes coming up this month, so you won't want to miss them. If you've been enjoying our deep dives into Scottish history, it would mean the world to us if you could take a moment to leave a review on your podcast platform, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts or Podbean. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. We're active on Twitter, where you can find us at The History of SC1. That is at The History of SC1. We post updates, interesting facts, and would love to hear from you. You can also join our Facebook group page at The History of Scotland Podcast, where you can become part of our community and engage with fellow history buffs. Being part of the social community also means you get to be more involved, so do consider joining if you haven't already. A bit of an apology for this episode in terms of any mumbling of words or pronunciations. Bit of a messy episode, tried to re-record certain bits, but I've done it to the best of my ability. The next episode will make sure to strive to be a lot better, and since it'll be a shorter time frame as well, I don't think it will be as hard to record. But as always, your support and feedback and engagement are what keep us going and make this podcast a special thing to do during my free time. So thank you once again for tuning in. You can find this podcast on all major platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google, Podbean. So make sure to recommend it to a friend or a family member who might be as passionate about Scottish history as you are. But until then, until our next episode, have a great week, guys. Enjoy yourselves. Stay safe. Stay safe in this heat. Goodbye for now. Catch you all on the next one. Peace.